Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, I've got a big question for you. Are you living a fulfilling life? What makes your life worth living? These are some of the questions our guests today are helping their students at Yale University answer. And today we're going to talk about the book that they wrote that is titled Life Worth Living, A Guide to What Matters Most. And with us today, we have two of the three authors of the book, Matthew Crozman, who is director of the Life Worth Living program at the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. He's also a staff pastor at the Elm City Vineyard Church. Matthew, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
As well with us is Ryan McAnally-Linz. He's an associate director of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. Ryan works at the intersection of theology, ethics, and cultural criticism. And Ryan, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thanks, Larry. It's so great to be here.
Well, as we listen to these two authors talk, I hope you'll join in the conversation. Tell us what gives your life meaning, or maybe share the wisdom about living a good life that you've gained over the years. Easy to do. You can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Now, your book came out of a class a very popular class that you both team teach at Yale University. And as an aside, I have a friend whose daughter is at Yale University, and I couldn't get a hold of her to find out. She's on the Yale hockey team, too. I couldn't find out if she had taken your class yet, but apparently it's a very popular class. What the heck gave you the idea for the class in the first place?
So about 10 years ago, our co-author Miroslav and I were looking at the campus scene and found ourselves thinking, you know, students have these really big existential personal questions that they wrestle with. That usually takes the form of like late night dorm room conversations. But there aren't a lot of opportunities in the curriculum for them to take those questions and bring them into the classroom. And so we thought we really should provide a space where students can have the best of their intellectual energies, the kind of stuff that they bring to their other classes, but marry that with the existential questions, the things that are keeping them up at night. And so Life Worth Living, this class, came out of that. And we found that it hit the spot, that students responded really well to having this opportunity to put those two things together.
What have students told you, and maybe Matthew, you can take this one, what have students told you that they have gained from the course?
You know, it really varies a lot from student to student. For many students, one thing I think that we do see happening with a number of students is that they connect deeply with the traditions, whether they're cultural or religious traditions, of their grandparents. Often our students find that their parents intentionally or unintentionally sort of moved away from traditions that they were maybe raised in, but there's still that connection through a grandparent to a deep cultural tradition or religious tradition. And so sometimes in our course, our students will sort of find their way back to that tradition and begin to sort of take a second look at it and consider, hey, maybe there are some resources here. Maybe, you know, mom and dad were right to push back on this aspect or this thing, but maybe there's some other aspect of this tradition that would really help me approach some of the bigger questions in my life. We've also had students who get back in touch with us and say, I mean, I'll never forget a note that I got from a student who said, sent me a note saying, you know, in my final Life Worth Living paper, I described a good life as being a life of courage in service to others. I write you from, you know, 6 weeks in or whatever it was into my job at the Innocence Project. I've been spending the last, you know, few months of my life trying to help innocent people clear their names. I'm not sure I would have had the courage to take this step and move my career in this direction if I hadn't taken this course. So those bits of feedback are really obviously that's a note you put up on the bulletin board next to you and keeps you going every day.
Yeah, that's for sure. I teach at the University of Wisconsin. I've taught many courses over a long lifespan, and it's always a pleasure to, you know, get an email or a letter, sometimes even years later, from a student who you may have touched in that way. I learn a lot from students too, Ryan. Well, both of you maybe. How has teaching the course changed how you think about things? Ryan, start with you.
So I think teaching the course has made me less scared of disagreement. I mean, just kind of personally at a personality level, I don't like conflict. And so the thought of having conversations about important things where you know going in that you don't see eye to eye is a scary thing for me personally. And to have been doing this for this many years with really smart students who aren't going to pull punches, but having it work out repeatedly has been really encouraging. I think we can have truth-seeking conversations about what matters most if we go in with a commitment to really listening and to mutual respect.
Yeah, and for me, you know, this is actually one of our favorite ways to end the course each year is for us to share back with our students. It is, as you mentioned, a team-taught course, and for the teaching team to sort of stand up and say to our students, hey, this is what we've learned alongside you. As we've asked these questions together, and one thing in particular I remember from a few years back was some students articulating multiple different students in the same group, as Ryan said, with real differences between them, but nevertheless there was an idea that really stuck out to them, which was just investing in a local community, which I think is a really counterintuitive instinct for students, especially at a place like Yale, or I think like in universities in general, it's sort of like, oh, we go to a university to get sent off to the far corners of the earth. But these students had this sort of picture of, they were really drawn to this sort of picture of where your worldview was big, but your life was geographically small, right? They said, I want to have a small life, but a big view, right? Big perspective. And I thought that was really intriguing, right? It's something that, as a sort of vision of life, and I could see the way it captivated them and the ways that it even reflected, helped me reflect on my own life and the decisions I've made to sort of invest locally in a neighborhood, in a town, in a city, put down some roots. It's always surprising every year. There's always something new.
An email from John. We often don't talk about theologists, theology on the show, and he's wondering what kind of questions do theologists study?
I mean, one of the things that drew me to theology is that every question has a theological side to it. There's no question that's out of bounds. So really anything that you can pose as a human question, you can take up from a theological perspective, which is just to say with a view to, I'm working in the Christian tradition. So what is God's relation to the world have to do with this thing? And then you run with it.
Yeah.
St. Thomas Aquinas said that theology is the study of God and all things in relation to God. So there's no, theology isn't the study of some small set of things, the way we think of a lot of other fields sort of have their defined scope that they're concerned with.
Yeah.
But theology is a matter of theology is adverbial. It's a way of asking questions about anything. And I think that that's trying to ask what for questions instead of maybe how to kinds of questions, right? We're asking questions about ends rather than about means. And I think that makes theology actually a really important discipline for us to sort of reconnect to, as Ryan said, whether or not we're religious, just because these are human questions. And I think theology, maybe some philosophy as well, help us ask those questions in ways that These days, there's very few other impulses to ask what for questions instead of how to.
Yeah, well said. So what brought you to this book? Why'd you write this book?
Well, I think we had as you said, it came out of this course. And after we've had these conversations with students we just taught the 10th edition of the course, having these conversations with these students was one thing, which is extraordinary. But we also started to find, unsurprisingly, hey, these are human questions. People everywhere are asking these questions. And so even before we wrote the book, we were having conversations with folks who weren't wrestling with quarter life crises, but maybe were wrestling with midlife crises, or maybe people whose questions weren't, what do I do after I graduate, but how am I going to make my retirement meaningful? Or the group of students that I taught at a federal correction institution here in Connecticut, right? Folks who are in prison also really wrestling with these questions and taking them really seriously. And the more sort of different communities that we took these questions to, and just as you've been asking, learning alongside them, learning from them, learning better how to articulate these questions, we thought, we really want to bring this to a broader audience. And the book, really, that's our hope with the book, is to be able to share a little bit of what we've learned, not so much about the answers to the questions, but maybe about how best to ask the questions themselves, what's kind of at stake in each little part of these questions, what the different options are, so that each one of us can responsibly turn and answer for ourselves.
Well, I really enjoyed the book, and I loved your great writers too. I thought, man, I can see why this class is so powerful and so popular, as you do a wonderful job with it. And we're going to dig into that book, whose title is Life Worth Living, A Guide to What Matters Most, with our two guests, Matthew Grossman and Ryan McAnally-Linz, right after we take a look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. We'll be back with our two guests, and we'll dig into that book right after this news and finding out what else is in store. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.
Downtown Middleton comes alive with art, music, food, and fun at Art Walk Middleton on Saturday, May 20th. Dozens of area artists show their paintings, jewelry, photography, and more in this one-day event. WPR is pleased to support art and art lovers. Find out more at wpr.org/events.
Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about the book Life Worth Living, A Guide to What Matters Most. And joining us are two of the three authors of the book. Ryan McAnally-Linz is Associate Director of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. And Matthew Crosman is Director of the Life Worth Living Program at the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. And as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in with your own experiences. Tell us about an experience you've had that changed the way you view life, maybe. What advice do you pass on to younger generations? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Well, I'm not a marketing guy, but when I looked at the introduction to your introductory chapter, its heading is "This book could wreck your life," and I thought to myself, well, I'm not sure a marketing person would say that's the best way to start a book, by telling the person that could wreck their life. And that may be a springboard for telling us what the book is all about. And maybe we could start with that. And Ryan, do you want to take that?
Yeah. I mean, I hope that there's a little bit of the allure of the dangerous there, right? We all like to play with fire a little bit. But two things are worth saying. So one, all of us are kind of, we generally just living our lives going along, and our lives have a certain direction and shape and rhythms to them that develops over time, partially intentionally, partially unintentionally. And oftentimes, if we do take the time to stop and think about it, we'll realize that it's taken turns in a direction that we can't ratify. We can't support the way. It's not going in the direction we would choose if we were thinking about it with our best, clearest thinking, and if we're going after what we consider truly to be meaningful. And in that case, the sort of changes that you realize might need to happen look like wrecking your life from the perspective of the old direction you were going in. But they look like a sort of saving of your life, a reorienting towards the good from the new perspective. And so there may be some wreckage there, but it's wreckage that you're thankful to have. And the second thing to say is we say it might wreck your life. It's also possible to go through these processes of discernment and say, hey, look at that. Like, there's something really substantive here. I can affirm the life that I'm living. I can now kind of more firmly hold on to the shape of my life, knowing that it's rooted in a vision that I really believe in.
I love how you had sort of four modes of life. I love that. And that was right away in the beginning of the book, which was sort of, let's see, there was autopilot, which is, all right, what do we do every day, more or less? And what's the next one? Effectiveness,
So then the next one is effectiveness, right? Where we start to say, well, hold on, is what we're doing, are our habits actually getting us where we want to go? And that can be a really important question to ask. But it's probably not the most important question we need to ask, because if all we ask are effectiveness questions, well, we're back to asking only how-to questions and never what-for questions. And so we say, well, we generally typically try to move a little bit deeper and get to the sort of self-awareness level where we ask, well, hold on, what actually, before we jump into the question about whether what we're doing is getting us what we want, maybe we should spend some time thinking about what it is we actually want.
You call that a lonely place.
It can be, right? Because there it's only about you, right? Like, you can't ask the person next to you, what do I want? I mean, maybe people who know you well can give you some insight into that, but that's ultimately just a question for you. The downsides there is that can be a lonely place. There's also, just because you want it doesn't necessarily mean that it's worth wanting. And that's that sort of transition that gets us down to our most fundamental level that we talk about in the book, which is this level of self-transcendence. And I mean, maybe that's in part where the sort of wreckage of a way of life that needed to be wrecked is part of what happens. And that's really, you know, I think it's really important for us. This is sort of, actually, that chapter has been sort of my stump speech for this project for a number of years, because I really think it gets to the core of the question that we tend not to ask, which is this: is what I want actually worth wanting? Our world is just full of people who surely want to help refine what it is that we want, the right marketers who want to call out of us all kinds of desires and cravings, and then all kinds of folks who are going to tell us how to go get whatever it is that we want. But it strikes us that you look at the philosophical and the theological traditions over human history, and they're not satisfied with suggesting that a good life is one where you just go get whatever it is you want. They're asking more fundamental questions about truth, about worth. Are these things that we're chasing after actually worth wanting in the first place? And we think once you ask that question, first of all, you're not so alone anymore. Because actually, it turns out, as you said, the world's great traditions, philosophers from Plato to Confucius on forward, have been asking this question for a long time. The world's great religious traditions have been asking this, the Buddha, Jesus, the Prophet Muhammad. We're actually in the midst of a conversation that maybe if it's a little bit foreign to us because of our obsessively how-to kind of means-oriented world, Maybe these questions feel a little unfamiliar to us, but man, it's like the mane in the plane for a lot of these wisdom traditions that stretch back centuries. And so it's not so alone there. And it's also, we're not so alone when it comes to one another. We actually are right in the thick of conversations that have to do not just with my life personally, but with asking something about what is the worthiness of our shared humanity. And now we have a project together. And we might have to, as Ryan said in the earlier segment, we might find ourselves in conflict with one another over that. We might disagree. But it's a game that we're playing together. It's a quest that we're on together, and we share it together with those around us to build the lives that we think are worth living, to build the world we think is worth living in. And that's really where, you know, this whole project really just sort of, I think this whole quest really sort of takes off.
Yeah, for sure. Dan in Stevens Point has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Dan. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for putting me on the air. I just wanted to make a call I'm sure that your guests will agree with, and that is involvement in community service one way or another. I retired in 2010, and soon after that I got involved with a local food pantry, the largest food pantry here in the Stevens Point area. And I find that very rewarding. And I also got involved with an organization called Citizens Climate Lobby, which is working on the climate issue, which in my opinion is the most important moral issue of our time. And so I got involved with those two things. And I have found great meaning in my life from my involvement in both of those. I'm not trying to pitch either of them for anybody specifically. It's just that I think we all have to think outside of ourselves. If our only goal in life is to be personally happy, we're in serious trouble.
Yeah. Dan, thank you so much for calling. Comment.
Yeah, so I've been asked a lot in talking about this book about happiness.
Yeah.
Do we know how to get it? And if so, what's the answer? And he's made a really great point here that it may be about investing your life in something other than your own happiness. It may turn out to be the case that whatever kind of fulfillment we're actually looking for is more likely to come from that than from trying to get it directly by means of focusing on ourselves. Now, there's a risk there, and the risk is that you turn service into a means of your own fulfillment. The trick is this: actually invest your life in something other than your own happiness, and let the happiness thing come or not as it may.
Well, and you talk about, you give some wonderful examples throughout each chapter of your book, as a matter of fact. And you think about people who lived somewhat terrible lives, but yet were, in the end, made a huge impact.
Yeah.
Lincoln, Christ.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, well, there's a vision that we refer to with the shorthand of, we call it the Walgreens vision, making an appeal to, I think, a now defunct slogan of the Walgreens brand, which, right, it used to be at the corner of happy and healthy. But there's this vision of a good life where we think that's where a good life is. It's at the corner of happy and healthy and long. We want a long, happy, healthy life. And yet it, as you say, it seems that we can look through history and even just look through our own sort of mental file cabinet of lives that we really, really admire that in one way or another, either were not long, were not happy, or were not healthy, or maybe some combination of all three of those, to see that actually, in many ways, the thing that we're looking for, the substance of a good life, may be those things for which we're willing to sacrifice longevity or happiness or a certain sense of health. You know, I mean, ultimately, a question we don't want to shy away from in the book is to know what you're, what's worth living for, maybe you need to know what you would be willing to die for. And again, as we look through history, many of the lives that we're drawn to, that we admire, that we might even in some sense try to imitate, some of those are people, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, others who knew what they were willing to give their lives for. And those, if that's a, for King, it was the beloved community. It was the evidence of the reality of God's work and transformation of society and culture, God's transformation of the world. But whatever that is for us, when we, it's a hard question to want to ask, but when we can start to answer the question, what would I be willing to die for? We may be right at the heart of discovering what it is that truly makes our lives most worth living.
Yeah. Sometimes we're shocked into it. I remember your chapter on how should we live. There was a guy, Heifetz, I think his name was, last name.
Yeah. Heifetz, so, yeah. So this is a fellow New Haven resident, a guy named Mohammed Heifetz. And he's a very successful architect. And one day got a call from his brother-in-law, who unbeknownst to him had fled the civil war in Syria and wound up in a refugee camp in Sweden, I think it was. And this kind of, he went and visited, and it turned his life upside down because he realized, wow, what I've been here chasing this kind of career success while my home country, Syria, has been burning. And what have I been doing about it? He gave a lecture at one of our Yale Life Worth Living classes. And if I could share one thing he said, I think it's really illuminating for the way this kind of reflection and the engagement with these traditions can shape our lives. He's a Muslim and always has been. And there's a doctrine of the judgment that there will come a day when God will raise us all up and call us to account for our lives. Say, what have you done?
And he thought, I built shiny new buildings or something like that.
Right, you're right. He imagined himself having to give the answer to God. You know, what did you do while Syria was burning? I built some shiny buildings. That's not going to hold up as an answer. and it shifts the direction of a life, right? And it's that being open to that kind of shift is precisely the key, the thing that you need in order not to get stuck in a trivial form of existence.
Another person that I remember from the book was, and I think a person who was lectured in your class was Julia Wise. Mm-hmm. And Matthew, maybe talk about her for a second.
Yeah, so Julia is part of a community that is known as effective altruism. So she's an effective altruist and has worked for a number of years at the Center for Effective Altruism. And she, what she sort of discovered in life was she was sort of middle class college student trying to like find her way into professional life. But she started asking herself some questions about how she spent her money. The thing about money that makes it such a potent little pressure point for moral reflection, right, is that dollars are what economists say they are fungible. A dollar in one direction can become a dollar in another direction rather easily, right? And so it became this question she sort of asked, like, if I were not to buy this ice cream cone and instead donated it to a charity, what good might that money actually do in the world? And as she started to get a greater and greater sense of how small, for example, public health interventions, like buying bed nets to prevent malaria for children in the global south, those are really cheap interventions. But the impact that those small amounts of money might have on somebody else's life, she started to look at all of her expenditures in her life and began to ask herself, well, how can I possibly justify spending money on myself if spending that same money on, you know, malaria bed nets would eventually save the life of a child on the other side of the world? And she eventually found that those sorts of little questions, right, that began, you know, and just sort of having that, I don't know, asking herself some questions as she pulled the, you know, the $2.50 out of her pocket to buy the ice cream cone, right? That eventually sort of turned into, well, hold on, like maybe this should impact the whole way I think about my life, how much money I earn, what I should do with all that money. She and her husband committed to giving away half of their income every. I mean, they have some decent paying jobs, so that's possible for them. But they've really restructured their lives, right? That all began with those little questions of like, wait a minute, how do I spend my money? And how does that really reflect my values? And why is my life, why is my, you know, enjoyment of some sort of luxury or pleasure in my life more valuable than the health and well-being, say, again, of a child on the other side of the world? That's a really... I'll tell you that becomes that's a kind of thinking that will like get stuck in your head and really start to change the way you make some decisions. And, you know, she goes on to really have to like wrestle with like, well, you know, when is enough, when is enough enough? And that becomes really, really hard to sort of gauge there. But I really personally, and I know Ryan does too, we really just respect the sort of moral courage to let that question come at you, right? And try to give that kind of account for what it is that we do with our money, how we spend it, who we spend it on, whose well-being is in mind as we spend and invest our money.
I'm thinking now about there are those of us who have lived a long life already and are looking back and wondering, well, is there still time? I'm thinking of the movie Living. I don't know if you saw, either of you have seen the movie Living. Bill Nighy had an Academy Award nomination for it. He was somebody who lived his whole life as a bureaucrat and often just set things aside and then learned he was going to die in a short time. And there had been a group of women who had been pushing to get a playground, and he had put them off for a long time. And he first he didn't even know how to have a good time, so he had to find somebody to show him how to have a good time. But then in the end, he worked and got that playground. In the end, before he died, and he made it. I guess I'm saying is no matter what stage of your life, it's I think it's good to read Life Worth Living: A Guide to What Matters Most.
Yeah. My grandmother recently died at the age of 96. You know, my book had just come out and we were talking and she kind of made a joke and it was too late for me. but it wasn't in a really important respect. So she had very few capacities in the last weeks of her life. And yet, she died on my son's birthday. A few days later, in the mail came the birthday card from great grandmother. One of the last things she did was make sure that last birthday card that she'd been sending everybody a birthday card for years went out and got to my son. And I think that's just another way of you know, making the point you were making that that our lives, they do come to an end. Our capacities come to an end. But as long as we're living, it's worth living well.
Cindy in Green Bay wondered if the class is available online or through Coursera or whatever. But does the book walk us through the class, sort of? It sounds like a wonderful program, and I would say that with the end of chapter guides and reflections, that the book really does do that job. And A Life Worth Living, well, it's probably a book worth purchasing and taking a look at and having for your very own. Thank you both very much, Ryan and Matthew, for being with us today. I really appreciate it. I enjoyed the book a lot. I hope a lot of people get to see it. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Larry. Great talking to you.
The book again, Life Worth Living, A Guide to What Matters Most. Thank you all for listening and stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Miller.